And welcome to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. It all happened in about an hour, Avi. Early Sunday morning, a tanker truck caught fire near the Cottman Avenue exit of I-95. The northbound lanes collapsed, and the southbound lanes were damaged so badly they have to be demolished.
There is still a lot we are learning at this hour, Cherry. We do know human remains were found at the scene. Mm-hmm. We know the rebuild will take a long time, likely months. And of course, this leaves a critical hole in our region's transit infrastructure. About 160,000 people travel this stretch of I-95 every day.
Yeah, this is serious. This is a very complicated story with sprawling implications, and we'll spend much of this hour sorting through it all. We know you've got thoughts about this. Commuters, Northeast Philly residents, truckers,
yep.
Call us 888-477-9499. You can also email us at studio2@whyy.org.
And then at the end of the hour today, we will talk about WHYY's new homegrown children's television show, Albie's Elevator. But before we get to all of that, Cherry, let's talk headlines.
Yeah, you got the shovel. Dig in.
So, of course, when you travel for work, Cherry, the first thing you do is that you call the people who are hosting you wherever you're going to go, and you demand that they find the best croissant in that city and deliver it to you upon arrival, right?
Maybe.
No, you wouldn't do that because that is a crazy thing to do, but that is apparently what two state employees from Rhode Island did when they came to tour the Bach Building in South Philadelphia as part of a redevelopment expedition. This is all alleged, we should point out. But basically, what is laid out in emails that were found by a couple of journalistic outlets up in Rhode Island, the Providence Journal and WPRI-TV, these emails suggest that these two men from Rhode Island came to South Philly and acted wildly inappropriately in ways that are sort of shocking. Mm. They were touring this building because this is a redeveloped building in South Philly, used to be a school, and they're thinking about doing a similar project with a vacant government building in Rhode Island. But they got down here and they started doing stuff that was sort of on some level amusing, but on other levels, like very disturbing. And now there are two separate state investigations in Rhode Island into these two state employees' behavior when they came here to Philadelphia.
It is wild because this is probably one of the most bizarre stories that I have read in a long time.
Yeah.
It almost feels like, you know, the House Husbands of Rhode Island type of reality TV show.
It's crazy,
because apparently the folks from Rhode Island reportedly made derogatory remarks, sexual advances toward the woman giving them a tour, and comments about people's ethnicity. It just sounds like officials from a government of any state would not act in this way. And by the way, those emails ended up in the governor's email box. And so this is why this rose to that level. And it's just so wild. I didn't even know how to think about this story.
It's hard
because
to process.
It's just hard to believe that it happened, but it did.
Yeah. And look, there's a silly side to this because some of the things like requesting the best croissant in Philadelphia be available upon arrival is sort of silly. But some of the stuff is not silly. It's bigoted.
Yeah.
And it's disturbing. We will reiterate it's all alleged. But when this story came out yesterday, everyone was buzzing about it because it was such a bizarre story.
By the way, one of the allegations is that, you know, someone, one of these Rhode Island folks called someone's dog overweight. You know how Philly people feel about their dogs.
I think everyone feels that way about their dogs.
Like, you talking about my dog? Like, that's a low blow. So, moving on from the bizarre story to a bit of good news, that boil water advisory that was in effect since Sunday afternoon in parts of Upper West Philly has been lifted today. That notice came out less than an hour ago, so we're all applauding for that. If you recall, that advisory had been put in place because of a pump that it failed to maintain the water pressure, and therefore it allowed for the potential of bacteria growth. It impacted about 18,000 residents in 3 zip codes in West Philly. The water department tested a number of samples. No evidence of harmful bacteria was found. So that's good news.
Yeah, good news. Of course, you know, it's like we're at the topic of the show today is infrastructure problem. Mm-hmm. this is an infrastructure problem. We've had other problems with the water recently. I mean, all sort of, in the cases of the water, near misses. And luckily, it seems like they were able to catch this and fix this. But yeah, you know, it's not exactly encouraging to be like, while you were sleeping, another infrastructure problem.
I know. But it also made me like think more about water and air. We just had air quality issues just a few days ago.
Basics.
Like, we need these, the air, water, you know, certain things to survive as humans on this earth. And so, you know, it just makes me like be even more grateful, you know, to have those things. Because today was, after that rain, fresh air.
Yeah, there was. It was very fresh. And luckily, the folks in West Philly now will have access to clean water. They can trust. They don't have to boil it. If they're having some chips, they can wash that down with a glass of water. And chips.
We're talking chips now.
So this is the second year in a row that the Hers potato chip company, you guys know Hers. They do this limited time thing where they release flavors of potato chip inspired by local businesses. And there are three finalists this year. And the way it works is they release the flavors of the three finalist businesses, and then one business sort of wins. They have the king flavor of that year. So this year, the finalists are a roast pork flavored potato chip inspired by John's Roast Pork near the IKEA down in South Philly.
I love John's Roast Pork.
There is a tomato pie flavored potato chip by Caropolis Bakery in Norristown. I was told by our producer, Paige Marie Bessler, there is some controversy about how to say the name of this business, but we are going with Caropolis Bakery in Norristown. And then finally, there is a Korean barbecue chicken wing flavor that is linked to Mike's Barbecue in South Philadelphia. And I have to say, because I have this platform, I am a regular customer at Mike's Barbecue in South Philadelphia, the best barbecue in the city, maybe the country. I think I'm allowed to be biased on a story like this, and I sure do hope they win because their Korean barbecue wings are unbelievable, Cherry.
Well, people, you can sample for yourself because the chips are sold until August 8th. By the way, I thought it was kind of cool that Ed Herr, the CEO of, you know, the chip company, is from Chester County.
Yeah, they're local.
Yeah, they're very local. I did not know that. And he just loved Philly flavors, of course. And this is a way for that company to highlight small businesses as well. So this is a big deal for those small businesses. Because look at you talking about the Korean barbecue. Now I got to go down there. And I just want to say that we're open to eating these chips.
We did look for them this morning. We went to Wawa, the local Wawa
Chip.
And they did not have them in stock yet. But we're told they'll be available any moment now. So tomorrow, perhaps,
we can have
a little taste test.
Okay.
But like I said, my bias is my bias. So I think I already know which one I'm going to pick.
All right. Well,
Mike's BBQ.
I'm going to lean in on the pork.
Okay.
So we'll see. Well, we want to get serious now because talk about I-95. We're now I'm going to switch over to the bulk of our discussion. We mentioned that bridge collapse in the northeast section of Philadelphia. Of course, this has caused major traffic delays as commuters try to work around and reconfigure their routes to work and to life. And so our guest first up is CBS News Philadelphia traffic anchor Chandler Lutz. Chandler, welcome to Studio 2.
Hello, Studio 2. Thank you so much for having me today.
Yeah, thanks for being here. So, Chandler, I can only imagine that this is a commuter's nightmare. Can you just describe to us the situation on the ground near that collapsed bridge site?
Yeah, I mean, this is really something that this doesn't happen. We haven't had anything happen even relatively close to this since 1996 with the tire fire on 95. So waking up Sunday morning to the news that 95 in the Northeast no longer exists is just unheard of. It's unprecedented. And now we have to make a shift to figure out how we're going to get around this large closure on 95. And it's not just for one direction. It's both northbound and southbound. So right now we are dealing with different reroutes, different detours. PennDOT has been great with overnight. They fixed the detour for us northbound and southbound, so it's a little bit easier. They put a number of these secondary, these sideway streets on flashing lights, so traffic begins to move. But I think the biggest thing right now is we're only in day two of our new commute without 95. And it's a lot different than yesterday. I think a lot of people yesterday, we were seeing the roadways a bit lighter. A lot of folks worked from home. We've been telling folks to take mass transit as an option. A lot of SEPTA regional rail stations have been opening up free parking. So that's been really nice. But today we really ramp things up. And I was on air all morning long talking about the heavy delays we were seeing and just the ripple effect across all of our area roadways now that 95 isn't an option.
Let's talk ripple effect. We have an email from Jeff who says, I have a planned flight in the near future. I live near the Commodore Barry Bridge. How is the bridge collapse on I-95 impacting travel to the airport? Are there any recommendations for travel time or safe routes to the airport? So the airport question, you can address that, Chandler, but also just generally, are we seeing overflow effects on other major arteries?
Yeah, so coming from the Commodore Barry Bridge, you have to think, so the Commodore Barry, I mean, it's somewhat of an issue as you travel across, you know, airport delays. That was definitely, you need to plan extra time to get to the airport. You're talking about different routes that we've been telling people to think about heading into New Jersey, different detours. If you're coming from Center City, if you're coming from South Philadelphia, Delco, and you need to travel to the northeast of Bucks County, Trenton area, we've been saying take the bend, the Commodore Barry into New Jersey to travel up 295, the New Jersey Turnpike, Route 130, and then you can get back on anywhere north of the Betsy Ross Bridge. We've been really telling you, even try to go a little north of Tacony-Palmyra. But as you mentioned, your listener was saying he's coming from the Commodore Barry Bridge. So to get to the airport there, you're not dealing with that 95 closure. So you shouldn't have to have too many detours. But if you're coming from anywhere, you know, in the Northeast, in Bucks County and Trenton, you need to get to the airport. That's where you're dealing with the biggest issue. And we've been saying Roosevelt Boulevard is a great option, Route 1, but also you have to think Roosevelt Boulevard is getting all the overflow from 95. So that has been pretty stacked as well, just in the past 2 days.
And when I hear you say this, like, you know, I'm geographically challenged personally. And so there's a lot of folks who are trying to, you know, map out how to get around, whether they're coming from the south or the north. Like, what should they be thinking about when they're trying to map out this new commute or new, route to wherever they're trying to go?
Yeah. And you know, what's really hard coming from my perspective, I'm trying to help all of our viewers and folks in the region get from point A to point B, but everybody has a different point A and point B. So the biggest recommendation is you need to make that plan and you need to figure out what routes you're going to take. Also take into account of peak rush hours here. Mm-hmm. That's where your normal 15-minute commute can take upwards of 45 minutes. We've been talking to folks that have just had a nightmare of a commute the past few days. Mm. So you need to make that plan. I would allow plenty of extra time, especially if you're going somewhere like catching a flight to the airport or somewhere where you need to be on time. You need to make that plan. You need to be patient as well, because, you know, a lot of accidents happen from frustrated drivers, and we're already dealing with so much added volume. We're trying to not have any more accidents and delays on top of what we're already dealing with.
Chandler, how does season affect this? This is obviously going to last for a while, but it's starting in the summer. I'm not sure how volume changes on that part of I-95 during the summer typically. Can you give us a sense?
So we look at 95, and of course to us it's major, but it's not just for us. I mean, 95 travels from Maine to Florida. It's a critical link to travel across the East Coast. So you can even think a family traveling from Maine and wants to get to Disney World, or, you know, they're traveling 95. It's just an example of how many folks we see. People take 95 to get to our shore points as well, to the Poconos area. So it's critical here. And with summer, we see a lot of summer vacations, a lot of summer travel. You know, coming up in a few days, it's going to be our first Friday. It's looking like a nice weekend at the beach. So 95 is really going to impact that and not having it. So that just means our area bridges are going to be packed. That means the Schuylkill Expressway, the Vine, and our other, you know, major roadways in the area are just going to be very heavy. So you need to budget that extra time that you normally wouldn't have to now that 95 isn't available.
Yeah. And as we wrap up, are there any other ripple effects that we should be considering as we, you know, as we try to plan around this for this summer?
Yeah, I would say, I know it's easy to think about just taking 95, you know, northbound, all traffic is forced off at Aramingo Ave and the Betsy Ross Bridge, which is exit 26. southbound. All traffic is forced off at Cottman Avenue, exit 30. And I know it's just an instinct to say, you know what, let me hop on the highway, let me get off at the detour points, follow the detours and get back on. But from what I've been seeing just the past few days, that is where we're at the heaviest at the closure point on 95. So I know it might be an easy option. It might just be easy to put in the GPS and say, let's do this. But I really recommend thinking of the other roadways.
We have to leave it there, but thank you so much. That is Chandler Lutz, CBS News Philadelphia traffic anchor. We have much more on this story to come on Studio 2. Stick with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
Hello, folks. I'm Avi Wolfman here.
We are continuing our conversation now about that I-95 road collapse. Get your questions and comments in. Our number is 888-477-9499. You can also email us at studio2@whyy.org.
We're going to do this segment a little differently than most of our middle segments, Cherry. We're going to do kind of a carousel. We're going to bring a few guests in throughout the course of this segment, folks who can talk about different angles of this story. And we're going to start with Scott Sauer, who is Chief Operating Officer at SEPTA. Scott, welcome to Studio 2.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So, Scott, remind folks, what are the service changes you have made since the roadway collapse on I-95?
Yeah, sure. We've been working pretty hard since Sunday morning to try to put together a plan to help the region. And, we think we've put together something that, at least in the short term, has been adequate to address what we're seeing. The first thing we took a look at is basically our regional rail lines that run adjacent to I-95. And that's something that we've done in the past when I-95 was under construction. We supplemented some service on our Trenton regional rail line, which is really the best alternative right now for, I think, most folks who are coming south from Upper Bucks County and places like that, where we were able to cobble together three additional trains. That's a total of 14 cars that we added, and those were two trips out of Trenton and a trip out of Holmesburg Junction that we were able to add in, and then three opposite trips in the afternoon, basically going from Center City back to the points that they started in the morning. We were able to do that, and then in addition, we've been able to add some cars to the trains that are already scheduled on Trenton, West Trenton, and Fox Chase. We've put together 22 additional cars in the AM peak periods, and then 21 in the PM peak. In the PM peak. So we've been able to add capacity, which was really important to us. We already had lots of capacity on our existing service. So, we're still recovering from pandemic ridership drops, but we even added to that. So we've been able to put together a lot of extra room for folks to accommodate. We're using it, but certainly not all of it. There's lots of room left for people to add to our trains.
That's wonderful. And before I ask the next question, we got a comment from a group of listeners in Chester County. They wanted us to acknowledge the driver, Nathaniel Moody, who lost his life. So I just want to take a moment. There have been reports that human remains were found in that wreckage, but they had not yet been confirmed or identified. But the driver of the truck has yet to be accounted for. His name is Nathaniel Moody. His cousin, Isaac Moody, told our news partner 6ABC that Mr. Nathaniel Moody had been a truck driver experienced for many years. And of course, we have not yet confirmed that those remains that were found in that wreckage were his. And so it's such a sad loss, and we want to acknowledge the loss of life here. Back to Scott Sauer, Chief Operating Officer of SEPTA. So I want to ask you, Scott, I mean, SEPTA ridership had been down. This is truly a tragic situation, but is this also an opportunity for SEPTA and just mass transit generally to step up and fill a major void here?
Yeah, certainly. And first, let me acknowledge what you just reported on behalf of the SEPTA family. I mean, we extend our condolences to the family and Mr. Moody and certainly to anyone affected by that. But to your question, in the face of adversity, this is an opportunity for SEPTA to really shine here and provide a service to the region that's sorely needed. but at the same time, trying to attract returning riders, people who may have gotten away from SEPTA with the pandemic, and even new riders who maybe have traversed I-95 for several years and now are seeing some advantages to taking SEPTA. And we're viewing it as an opportunity. We're trying to put our best foot forward. We've employed lots of additional staff to get out to stations where we anticipate additional ridership to teach people how to use our fare instruments, to teach people how to read timetables and things of that nature that maybe some folks aren't able to do or haven't had to do for years. So we are looking at this as a bit of an opportunity to demonstrate that SEPTA is a great choice for traveling throughout the region, whether you're in a horrible situation like we're facing now, or just for regular lifestyle choices, whether you're commuting back and forth to work or going on shopping trips or just going to visit grandma. You know, we're a great choice for people to travel throughout the region.
Scott, are these changes that SEPTA has made in response to the roadway collapse, are they indefinite? Have you all pledged to keep them in place as long as the roadway is closed?
Yeah, we're going to keep this going as long as possible. You know, we're going to examine what the use and ridership is as we move forward. And certainly if it's being used, then we're going to keep it in place. We did have to sacrifice some service on other routes, so we'll have to monitor that as well. I mean, we don't typically have equipment that's just kind of laying around waiting for a use like this, where we press all of our rail cars into service every day. So we are looking for ways to kind of move equipment around, get it to the places it's most needed. And we are going to keep this in place as long as it's needed, as long as it's being used, for sure.
And so what's the target you have to hit there? Is there a number you're looking at to say, yeah, we're going to keep this in place?
Well, we're still evaluating ridership. We've seen some increases, but certainly not at the levels that we're hoping for. You know, like I said earlier, there's still lots of capacity on the system. So we're going to wait and see. I mean, with the changes in ridership patterns after the pandemic, we've seen ridership at its heaviest in the middle of the week, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. So Wednesday and Thursday, we'll be able to reevaluate kind of how things are going. But we're certainly not going to pull the plug too early, because we realize that people are still making decisions. They're testing the detour routing, maybe testing their travel times. But we want folks to know that you know, our travel times in the city haven't changed. And so if you're seeing increased travel times driving, SEPTA might be the better option for you. So we know that's going to take some time for people to evaluate.
Yeah. And before we let you go, what are resources for folks who may not be used to using regional rail, but they want to, you know, sort of dip their toe in now? How should they be planning their commute?
Yeah, we have lots of resources for folks to check us out, to learn our timetables. Certainly our website, SEPTA.org, is the best place. You can review all of our timetables for all of our services, including regional rail. Our SEPTA app that you can download through Apple or Google is another great resource, where you can mark lines as favorites. You can get notifications on service interruptions or delays. You can plan your trip. All that can be done through our app and our website. And of course, our Twitter feed at SEPTA is a great place to get good information and to even speak with SEPTA representatives. So there's lots of great places. And then the last place, of course, you can certainly call our customer service line at 215-580-7800. And we extended the hours of our call center starting the day at 6 a.m. So you can call in and get train schedules and next arrivals and everything that you need there.
Thank you so much, Scott. Thanks for joining us on Studio 2.
Thank you very much.
That was Scott Sauer, Chief Operating Officer for SEPTA. He mentioned a number. I'll mention one as well. That's our number here at Studio 2, 888-477-9499. If you want to make a comment, leave a comment, talk to us on air. You can also email us, studio2@whyy.org. Now we're going to shift gears a little bit and talk a bit about gears, about the mechanics and the engineering behind what happened and what needs to happen moving forward to fix this collapsed section of roadway. And to address some of those questions, we have brought in Andrew Bechtel, professor and chair of civil engineering at the College of New Jersey. Andrew, thanks for joining us on Studio 2.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm happy to help.
I guess we should start with some basics. How does heat cause a bridge collapse? Walk us through the mechanics. I know you don't know exactly what happened here, but more generally, what happens when heat is applied to a structure like this?
So as part of any highway bridge, there's metal. Metal we have historically shaped and changed through heat. A blacksmith changed the shape of iron by heating it up and making it malleable. So the same thing happens when you light a large fire under a bridge. As the temperature increases, the steel and metals become more malleable and they're able to move more than intended.
And so this bridge area collapsed. Explain how, you know, when the structure of the, I guess, you know, the steel becomes more malleable and it expands, I understand, in some cases, how it affects the structure, the strength, and how we were able to see this collapse, and then the instability of the other side of the bridge.
So there's kind of two things you wrapped into that question. Mm-hmm. So steel bridges, any bridge, anything that we build, expands and contracts with heat. Thermal expansion is a thing that we deal with all the time. So going from winter to summer, a highway bridge gets gets shorter in the winter, gets longer in the summer. That's normal thermal expansion, and that's accounted for in the design. Now, generally with any steel structure, like a building, like a steel building, when we have fires on them or under them, the main concern is time. Mm-hmm. It's like, if a fire starts, how long does the building have? Can it withstand that fire so people can get away? So no structure is invincible to fire. It's generally how long will it last until something very bad happens and do people have time to get away?
Hmm. I mean, I think that brings us to something fundamental about this case, which is whether it is an instance of the inevitable. Look, if something like this happens near a bridge, any bridge, it's going to collapse. Or is there something we could be doing to reinforce structures like this to make them more resistant to heat? Are there different materials we could be using? Give us a sense of that part of it. Is this inevitable, or are there some steps that we could be taking to make these types of structures a little better in the future?
So as a civil engineer, as someone that studies engineering, thinks about engineering isn't so much it's a profession of trade-offs, right?
Yeah.
We can design rockets that go to the moon, right? It's more, we have to balance the performance with the cost, generally. We could design a bridge that could withstand this fire, but it would be a very, very expensive bridge.
Yeah.
So we design bridges on a reliability basis, and we have to look at everything that could happen. We look at the probability of it happening. So we can design anything as an engineer, but we have to balance it against the cost of building it.
Yeah.
So I guess your answer is, could we do better things? 100% absolutely. Would they cost more? 100% absolutely. If there was a simple, inexpensive thing we could do to make it better, engineers are hardworking people that work for the public. Yeah. They would be being done.
Yeah. And if you are just tuning in, we are speaking with Andrew Bechtel, professor and chair of civil engineering at the College of New Jersey. We want to hear from you. Are you a trucker? Are you impacted by the collapse of I-95 in Northeast Philadelphia? Are you retooling your commute? Call us. Talk to us. Let us know. Our number is 888-477-9499. You can also email us at studio2@whyy.org. So I saw the video. I've seen photos since the actual fire and collapse. When you as an engineer look at what happened, what stands out in your mind as some of the challenges that folks are going to face when trying to replace this stretch of the bridge?
So I guess the challenges are, one, where it's located. I'm a commuter. I commute from Philadelphia up into New Jersey. I drive across that bridge all the time. And that area of the city is super constrained in that you can go up 95 and there's one road that goes under 95. And those are basically the connections from south to north. So there's a lot of constraints maintaining access to all the properties and the different things that exist along the river, and well, maintaining access to the northeast of the city. The other thing is there was a lot of heat. That area is very confined by bridges and land mass. So that would have worked to hold the heat in. So they had a they had a lot of heat confined in a small area. And what they're going to really need to do is dig everything out and look and see what the condition of everything that is left. If the piers that were holding the bridge up are serviceable, there'll be a lot of forensic work that needs to be done to see what the condition of what's remaining is. We know that the bridge spans have to come out, but we also don't know what the heat affected the foundations and stuff.
As much as you feel comfortable speculating on this, when they do that type of forensic work, will it have a big impact on the timeline here? Are we talking about the difference between 2 months and 8 months, or are we talking about generally a smaller impact based on what those forensics reveal?
I guess I would base my timeline exclusively on what the forensics say, because we're very good at building new bridges, and a brand new everything has a certain timeline associated to it. If there's anything left over that can be used, then that would certainly shorten the timeline. But like I said before, I know the governor has committed to months. And I would wait and see what the engineers say once they get in there and see what's remaining and what is that.
Interesting. Yeah.
And you know, you mentioned road design and how tight it is up there. We have a caller on the line, Luann, who wants to comment about that. Luann, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, Cherry. Thank you so much for taking my call. When I heard this, the first thing that occurred to me was how I remember when the Blue Route connected up with the Schuylkill, and how repeatedly there were tractor trailers that would jackknife on that off ramp because they were taking it just a little too fast for how the ramp was designed. And so, not to cast any aspersions on this hardworking gentleman who was driving the truck. I myself am a school bus driver. I'm, you know, very familiar with handling large vehicles. And I think, you know, that there probably was some design flaw that helped contribute to this. And I hope that when they reconstruct it, that they're, you know, and of course, that there's space constraints are a problem there.
Yeah.
But to try and design that problem out.
Interesting. I mean, so Andrew, can I bring you in on that a little bit? I mean, is there room? There's a lot of moving parts here. You got to rebuild the thing. You've got to get the main part, the artery, up and running again. I suppose maybe there's also some room to try to do some redesign, or maybe there isn't. I mean, how would that factor into a rebuilding project like this?
So designing Philadelphia is a colonial city.
Yeah.
We live our lives in ways that they had no idea that we'd be living in the future. So when we do work in the city and people look at the city, there's always so many different constraints that you have to deal with when you're dealing with a highway and building something that big that carries cars going that fast. I mean, across the country, we have cities that are designed specifically to move by highway. But when Philadelphia was founded, that was not nearly the intention. And when you're looking at redesigns like that in areas, there are public right-of-ways, but you're also dealing with private properties. You have to deal with people and the things they own and the houses they live in.
Yeah.
So it's
very complicated.
There's no easy solution. We're always dealing with trade-offs, and we have to look at the different parts of that.
Yeah. And if you just tuned in, we're speaking with Andrew Bechtel, professor and chair of civil engineering at the College of New Jersey. I want to bring in WHYY's Tom McDonald. He's been reporting on this issue since the fire happened on Sunday. Tom, you're in Studio 2. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
Yeah, you were at a press conference today with top transportation officials. Who was there and what was the general message?
Well, Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg said that he wanted to reassure people.
At the end of the day, there's no substitute for I-95 being up and running in full working condition, and that's the goal that everybody's moving toward here.
And what he said is the key is to rebuild the span as quickly as possible.
We're going to continue to be here every step of the way for as long as it takes with both financial backing and any other technical support that's needed as PennDOT works to restore this and as local officials work to make sure that the impacts are managed and absorbed as much as possible.
So Tom, basically, it was a direct message, Avi, sorry about that,
go ahead.
That he really wants to say the checkbook is open and ready to write that check and any financial help there, plus any sort of technical help that the federal government can provide.
But I'm guessing, Tom, he wasn't putting numbers on it in terms of the amount of time it's going to take or the amount of money it's going to cost. Those details still forthcoming?
The interesting thing about this is the transportation secretary for the state of Pennsylvania said they expect the demolition to be done late today or tomorrow.
Hmm.
And once that's done, they have a way to fix this almost completed, and they will release it tomorrow.
Interesting, interesting. Actually, can I bring Andrew Bechtel back into the conversation? Andrew Bechtel's professor and chair of civil engineering at the College of New Jersey. Tom, a reporter, just played a clip about sort of doing this with expediency, but we got an email from a listener, David, who said, while the collapse is tragic and will be incredibly disruptive in the regions, are there thoughts to take advantage of the shutdown to fast-track other construction that's been ongoing on I-95 for years? I mean, Andrew, would that even be a possibility? It doesn't sound like that's what they're going to prioritize, but would that even be a possibility?
So, I mean, the other work, theoretically, upstream and downstream could go on. I don't know if the resources going to this divert from those other projects.
Yeah.
Certainly, I would hope that I always love when PennDOT has out the roving dump trucks when they clean out the inlets. If they could do all that inlet cleaning now, that would be convenient for me in my commute.
Yeah.
I guess I would imagine that if it didn't pull the oversight people who work from PennDOT away from their projects they're working on, I guess construction could continue, and unless getting materials to and from the site was interrupted.
Yeah, and Tom, I got to ask you this question. I mean, was there any updates on the driver of that crash tanker? Did we get any other issue regarding or any other update regarding those human remains?
Well, the state police officials were there, and they still are not confirming what basically everybody is reporting, that a truck driver out of Pennsauken was involved in this crash. The one thing that they are saying is they're doing all their due diligence. Plus, there is a social media video that has been circulating around with a long shot of how the crash occurred.
Mm-hmm.
They're analyzing that to make sure it's not any way faked or anything else happened. Because in that video, it doesn't look like the driver hit the brakes at any time. It looked like he was coming around the curve and went right into it. So that's the one thing about the situation right now. And in this day of deep fakes and everything else, they're making sure they dot the I's and cross the T's before they say anything officially.
And what's the timeline on this investigation? Because, of course, everybody's going to be, you know, wanting to hear what the official word is as to what happened.
Well, first of all, National Transportation Safety Board is involved in this. And I've been involved in a lot of instances where NTSB is involved. You get nothing for months.
Yeah.
They analyze. They take every fine grain of sand before they give you a complete outcome of their investigation. So don't expect anything overnight. And I think the bridge will be built before the NTSB report comes out.
Well, he is Tom McDonald, WHYY reporter, has been covering everything about this incident wall to wall. Tom, thanks so much for joining us on Studio 2.
Can I get one last piece in, guys? Do I have a second here?
Real quick.
The contractor has already been selected. Wow. They have got a contract already established. They're moving somebody who's doing some work a little further up on 95 to make this as fast as possible.
Well, that is Tom. Thanks so much for joining us, Tom. We also have to say goodbye to Andrew Bechtel, professor and chair of civil engineering at the College of New Jersey. Andrew, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Avi and Cherry, for having me. It was a pleasure.
We're shifting gears coming up. Yay. We are talking about Albie's Elevator, WHYY's just debuted children's program. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Cherry Gregg, and this is Studio 2. Well, that theme will, that's the theme to WHYY's brand new original kids program. It's called Albie's Elevator, and that song, Earworm, it's going to be in my head all day. Avi, tell us a little bit about the show.
So Albie, as you might infer from that intro, is an elevator operator, but it's not just any elevator. It is decked out and colorful, complete with a robot named Tibbetts. Albie navigates through social emotional conflicts with the folks who board her elevator, and the idea for Albie originally came from our next guest, Caitlin Corkery, who's also the head writer and WHYY's senior manager of series production. Caitlin, welcome to Studio 2.
Oh my gosh, thanks so much for having me, Avi and Cherry.
Yes, and we have to talk to the person behind Albie the puppet. Elizabeth Daypo is the star puppeteer, and she's with us today too. Elizabeth, welcome to Studio 2.
Oh, thank you so much. This is really exciting for me.
Yes, and we're sitting here with a big cutout of Albie behind us here in the studio, so you can just imagine that. But Caitlin, I wanted to sort of start with you. First of all, congratulations on the show.
Thank you.
To both of you. And where did the inspiration come from?
Yeah, sure. So the William Penn Foundation approached WHYY about creating original kids content, and I jumped at the opportunity. I originally started working at Sprout early in my career, which was a 24/7 preschool channel that operated out of the Comcast Center. So it feels like kind of getting back to what I originally was doing at the start of my career. And for Albie, I wanted a character who had big feelings, who felt things really, really on the high end of the spectrum, and her lows were really, really low, who was fun and playful, but also as an opportunity to kind of showcase local artists. So every episode of Albie, whatever she's going through, whatever social emotional problem arises in the episode, she takes the elevator into starling mode, very official, and she visits a real world artist or entertainer or arts educator, someone from the greater Philadelphia region, and she has an opportunity to see their creative process at practice and kind of hear from them about how they deal with it. So I love the idea of opening kids up to different art mediums and kind of hearing from real people. I had my daughter during the pandemic, so didn't go out a whole bunch. She was inside a lot. She didn't know what a shopping cart was. So the idea of being able to like introduce her to this kind of awesome world and this really vibrant art scene that Philadelphia has really appealed to me and was something that was exciting about developing the show.
I want to play a clip from yesterday's premiere episode called Elevator Voice. This is Albie activating the system for the first time to show her new viewers how it works.
Elevator buttons. Ready?
Elevator buttons are colorful, shiny, and activated. Ready?
Turbo freezer. Ready?
Freezing at turbo speed and full of delicious popsicles. Yummy!
Yahoo! And lastly, pep talk ready!
Pep talk. All we can control is ourselves.
Whoa.
Popsicles, you got me at popsicles, but all we can control is ourselves, Caitlin Corkery. I mean, that seems like philosophically in some ways what the show is about. It's about emotional regulation, it seems like. First of all, correct me if I'm wrong, but also if that is indeed, you know, fundamental to the show, why did you feel that was such an important thing to highlight in a program right now?
Yeah, so it's the whole curriculum overall is social emotional, right? So it's how you deal with your own feelings and then how you deal with your relationships with other people. And a lot of that, even the like subcategories and that thing are like recognizing and labeling your own emotions. And it feels like SEL is so fundamental to learning anything else. It's how you as a human are interacting with people. And if you have that as a basis, it goes even further in your other learning. And after the pandemic, not having the social component for kids, when we talk to guidance counselors or parents, those are the things that they really wanted kind of to see in kids programming. So that's what we were responsive to. And it's funny too, we had a meeting before every day we started shooting where we talk about what the episode was about. And it resonates for adults too. Mm. Telling adults all you can control is yourself is like a very calming thing, I think. It's like, cool, this is out of my control.
A lot of us take classes to learn that
we
lesson.
We do.
That's what I'm saying. But now you can watch Albie's Elevator.
That's right.
Yeah, take a class in like pottery or something.
That's right.
Watch Albie's Elevator instead.
And this is sort of like for you, Caitlin, and then pivoting to you, Elizabeth, as well. Why a puppet? Like, there's probably a lot of different ways you could have done a show on this, but talk about the puppet aspect.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the most honest answer is personal bias. I love puppets. I think they're really fun, but also puppet characters. I mean, as Liz will attest to, like you can really bring them to life. And I think because the puppet is the puppet becomes like an everyman in some sense, right? So Albie is a specific creature and she's a specific friend, but also kids can see themselves in her. She doesn't necessarily look like any kid who's watching, but also you can find similarities and you can find yourself in Albie. So I like that as a unifying force and kind of the face of the show. Plus having having Albie as the center of it allowed us to create a little bit of an imaginary world around her. So it's not a direct real life experience, even though we're seeing real life artists in those field packages. It also allows us to create a fantasy world, which can make things like a little bit more fun, a little sillier, and a little bit better than they might actually be. So that felt really fun for me.
Yeah. I think puppets are a great gateway character for kids. So any of the big puppet shows that we all are familiar with, and if you're an 80s kid, it was Fraggle Rock. Always have that puppet character that bridges the gap between the puppet world and the human world. And so she bridges that gap nicely with the Peps and all the little tiny puppets, but also, you know, you bring in the humans into the aspect of the story so kids can relate to both sides of it really easily.
And how do you voice and create and move a character in a way that it's relatable to children but not patronizing, I guess, to them? Like, what is your approach there as you try to get into the mind of this character and how it's connecting with that kid on the other side of the screen?
I don't know if you've noticed, but this is what I sound like almost all the time. So it's always been really easy for me to,
kids,
I have a connection, an easy connection.
Yeah.
I've always treated children just like little adults. I've never tried to talk down to them. When you want to teach a concept, you really want to go at it from the perspective of, here's the concept and I'm going to explain it to you. And if you have questions, ask me. So with Albie, she tackles a lot of these, you know, big emotions and big feelings. And when you want the puppet to really emphasize that she's sad, well, then her shoulders slump and her head goes down. And vocally, she might be up here when she's super happy. But then when something's really bothering her, like everybody sinks into themselves. And I think you really have to figure out what that emotion is. And sometimes I nailed it and sometimes I was really off the mark. So Caitlin would be like, let's try this again.
That's your Caitlin impression.
That's pretty good.
Rewind. So I think it's taking it moment by moment, but really investing. If you're invested in the character, then the kids are going to be invested with you. If you give 100% to whatever that character is going through, it's, you know, it's an acting technique, the Meisner method. If you live in the truth of the circumstance, those kids are going to follow you in.
Yeah. And I got to ask, because the first episode was about volume, mm-hmm. and I was always a loud talker. You probably know this, Avi, you could tell that about me. But talk about the curriculum and sort of like playing it out. How did you choose the different topics to and what's coming up? Because we only have about a minute and a half. Yeah.
So we started with a base curriculum that kind of broke everything out into, like, I would say about a dozen different categories. And we had this crazy spreadsheet. So it's the curriculum. It's arts partners that we want to work with who we think their work speaks to kids or speaks to some SEL topic. And then I was in every single Facebook mommy group being like, what do you want to see? We were talking to school guidance counselors. I have 23 cousins. They all have kids. So like any person anywhere, we were like, talk to us. What do you need? What do you want to see? And then from there, we would kind of mix and match and see what works. We pitched a ton of things. We worked with an educational consultant who would say, like, yep, this is great for kids, or developmentally, you're skewing a little old or a little too young. This wouldn't be on target for 2 to 5 year olds. And so many revisions, so many things. We have a great episode that I love that's coming up about boredom and how boredom can be, like, kind of reimagined as a great opportunity to be creative. That same episode, the second story, is about how things go away sometimes, how we can have a great experience and the process can be great, but doesn't have to stick around forever, which is, like, for my heart, the most important episode, because I struggle with that. Because Albie's great, and I want Albie to stick around forever, but it's okay if this is it.
So, 23 Cousins, first of all, the best focus group in the world. I wish we could talk more, but this is the end of the show, guys. Caitlin Corkery, show creator, head writer for Albie's Elevator. Elizabeth Depo, the puppeteer behind Elevator Operator Albie. First of all, both of you, congratulations on the launch of the show. We wish you a ton of success, and thanks for coming on our show, Studio 2.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, our producers today are Debbie Builder, Paige Murray-Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Al Banks is our engineer. And for more of our show, head on over to whyy.org/studio2. You can also download us wherever you get your podcasts. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. Thanks so much for joining us, folks.